This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today is the day we feature our monthly look at the law. This afternoon we welcome back to the program Illinois Appeals Court Justice Robert Steigman. You can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. The telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Illinois Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman serves on the 4th District Appellate Court. He was assigned to the court in 1989. He was elected Appellate Justice in 1994. Prior to his service on the Appellate Court, he served as Assistant State's Attorney in Sangamon and Champaign Counties. In 1976, he was elected Circuit Court Judge for the 6th Judicial Circuit. Your calls are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Judge Steigman, good afternoon. Welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Celeste.
It's been a while, hasn't it?
Well,
it's been a few months.
I think that's right.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Let's begin with a ruling you were involved with not too long ago in the on the 4th District Appellate Court involving truth in sentencing. And give us some background and what the ruling was.
Yes. In 1995, the Illinois legislature, in response to a lot of concerns people have had about the amount of time prisoners have been serving on the sentences that have been imposed upon them, amended the Unified Code of Corrections, which is the act which governs time in prison, in, among other things, to provide that for people convicted of violent crimes that there would be no longer day-for-day good time. Instead, they would have to serve 85% of their sentence, and this change was called truth in sentencing. I should explain that day-for-day good time means that if someone gets a 10-year sentence for any particular crime under the laws it was, they were eligible for release in 5 years. We abolished parole in this state in 1977, and I think it was an excellent thing to do. Parole being essentially come before some committee and try to convince them that you're all better now and it's time to let you out. Instead, we now have a situation where the judges impose sentences that have meaning, and in order to try to get prisoners to behave appropriately while in prison, the incentive provided in 1977 was called day-for-day good time, so that for each day that a prisoner is in prison behaving appropriately, mm-hmm. he would get 2 days credit on his sentence. So in a 10-year sentence, you could be eligible for release in 5 years.
And at the time, that was sort of thought of as truth in sentencing then, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, no, it really wasn't.
No? Oh,
it,
okay.
was a great improvement over the parole system, but I remember testifying in 1977 that we shouldn't have it at all. There is a real sense out there in the public, and appropriately so, given that there are 50 separate criminal jurisdictions in each of the 50 separate states, that sentences don't mean what they say. A life sentence, guy can get out in 11 years. A 25-year sentence means maybe he can get out in 7 years. This is the way it is, as a matter of fact, in perhaps North Carolina or Tennessee or Oregon, whatever. And it shouldn't be that way in Illinois, was my argument. Well, at the time, we didn't have near the penal facilities we now have. We built a lot of prisons since then, though we're still overcrowded. And the legislature accepted the argument from the penal people that we needed to give day-for-day good time as a necessary means of controlling prison behavior. With regard to 1995, with regard to violent crimes, as opposed to property crimes, the legislature said we want those convicted of these offenses to serve a longer period of time. 85% of their sentence, so that on a 10-year sentence, you'd have to serve at least 8.5 years, and if you're a good prisoner, you can get out then. If you weren't, you'd have to serve maybe 9, maybe 9.5, or the full 10-year mm-hmm. sentence. The problem was that when the legislature passed that bill, they violated the Illinois Constitution. That was the issue before the 4th District Appellate Court that I was on, and I was the author of the opinion that wrote that this bill was improper because of a short provision in the Illinois Constitution that reads as follows. Bills, except bills for appropriations or for codification or revision, none of which apply in this situation, shall be confined to one subject, unquote. Now, what does that mean? The Supreme Court of Illinois has interpreted it broadly so that by one subject it could mean any numbers of provisions that at least have some connection to one overarching theme, such as criminal law or civil procedure or tax policy, whatever, mm-hmm. or rules governing park districts in Illinois. But the court said that the various sections of a particular bill cannot be discordant. That was the term of art they used. Unfortunately, in this particular bill, 1995, the bill that was in which truth in sentencing was enacted, they had nine sections dealing with criminal law related matters, and the tenth dealt with the Hospital Lien Act. And we listened to the arguments of the state appellate prosecutor and said, no, this, there's no way you connect these two. In our judgment, these were discordant provisions, and the Fourth District then held that because of that, the bill, as the Supreme Court says is the remedy when this happens, the act in which this provision was contained was in effect declared void as if it was never enacted at all. And truth in sentencing went up in smoke. Now, it's regrettable because I think the policy underlying truth in sentencing is just fine. Mm. But it serves to point out that we judges are on occasion required to do things, to make rulings, consistent with our duty, indeed sworn duty, to the Constitution of the state of Illinois as well as the United States to uphold it, to make rulings that we believe that duty requires, like in this instance. And of course, a lot of the several of the legislators understood that maybe this was a mistake and they were sorry for it, and a few others decided it's a lot easier to beat up on the judges, and so, but that comes with the turf. But I thought your listeners might find some of this background interesting because this is what happened and that. And now, of course, there's a measure afoot to reenact it if that's necessary. There's some argument that it was reenacted a few years back anyway.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, in the meantime, as this is all being sorted out,
right?
What happens to the folks in prison who may or may not be now eligible for?
Well, the argument is that the bill was this provision was reenacted in May of 1996. So it's between August 1995 and May of 1996. There are approximately 1,500 people who were sentenced to prison, supposedly under the truth in sentencing provisions, where they'd have to serve 85% of their time. And as a result of this ruling and the holding this unconstitutional, they will only have to serve 50% of their time or more. Again, this is eligibility to be released, I want to emphasize. This is not that they will have to get out, but if they were good prisoners, right, they could be out at 50%.
Yeah. Any I know that as a judge on the appellate court, it's not your business to be in touch with the Department of Corrections to, you know, say, well, how are things going and what does this all mean? But have you heard anything in terms of?
Well, just that the Department of Corrections is going back to recalculate potential outdates.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially they're handling it as you might expect. They, you know, salute smartly. They understand this is now the ruling and that's what they're going to have to do. The case is going to go before the Illinois Supreme Court, I'm sure, because whenever any provision has been held unconstitutional in any state law, the Supreme Court almost always takes those cases. The parties have a right to get there. They can petition for leave to appeal as of right. And the Supreme Court of Illinois will be the last word on it, but we've made our decision. And a week after we did, the Second District Appellate Court came up with the same decision.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about some other things in the news here. Our guest this afternoon is Illinois Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Today's the day we take a look at the law and you. Our phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And let's talk about the tobacco case. I thought was very interesting. This week, the House Commerce Committee released tobacco company records, and R.J. Reynolds fought long and hard to keep those records confidential. And a judge in Minnesota said the tobacco company would the tobacco company, you lose. And the judge apparently said that there was potential evidence in these documents of fraud and possible crimes committed by company executives. And as a result of this situation, there have been some questions raised about attorney-client privilege. For example, did lawyers in the industry suppress evidence? Were documents withheld improperly? Were documents destroyed? And I thought it would be interesting to talk with you about attorney-client privilege. What is it? And, you know, where are the limits?
Well, the attorney-client privilege is a longstanding doctrine which exists to ensure people that their communications with their lawyers will be held in confidence, with the hope that people will be encouraged to speak in candor with their attorneys about serious legal issues affecting them or their business or their liberty, whatever it might be. The norm is that the law is entitled to everyone's testimony. That is, in a judicial proceeding or a grand jury proceeding, anyone should be can be subpoenaed, and anyone can be required to testify. It's one's duty as a good citizen, with certain exceptions. One of those would be privilege against self-incrimination, Fifth Amendment view. If your testimony might incriminate you, you have a privilege not to testify. Another privilege would be for an attorney or a doctor or someone's minister or priest not to testify to communications made in confidence and with the intent that they be private. Now, I mention this with intent because that's important. If you're, for instance, Celeste, at a bar after work having a beer and you happen to see your lawyer there who is advising you on some civil matter or some estate planning or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. and you walk up to that person and start asking your lawyer some questions or speaking about the matter that your lawyer is representing you about, and there is a third party or others with the lawyer standing at the bar, this is not a communication entitled to the attorney-client privilege because it wasn't spoken in confidence. By definition, if there are third parties present, the privilege doesn't apply. But the society has taken the view that because this notion of privilege is so important, we will say to lawyers that you shouldn't have to testify about things stated to you by your clients in confidence. Now, there are some limitations. For instance, an attorney cannot withhold information on attorney-client privilege that constitutes a criminal act itself or permit or assist the client in the planning or commission of a criminal act. The privilege does not extend that far, contrary to sometimes what you see on TV and the movies. The attorneys may not, in fact, in those stories, might not come forward, but the notion that the attorney-client privilege would forbid them from coming forward is wrong, that, in fact, they are duty-bound to come forward if they have that sort of information. So I'm not totally sure what is in the documents from the tobacco companies. That it was a crime after the fact, I'm not sure would make any difference. In other words, if the attorneys spoke with the tobacco executives and were providing legal counsel to these companies, and years later, executives from the companies made statements, even under oath, that would be inconsistent with what they told their attorneys years before. I think the attorney-client privilege would still apply to those early communications. You can't call someone's lawyer to try to bring out that that person has lied by something mm-hmm. that he or she told the lawyer years earlier. I'm not totally sure. There's just been speculation about what these documents contain. I'm sure that the judges who were dealing with these issues were sensitive to the notion that there's a attorney-client privilege or work product, attorney work product contained in these documents that they were turned over might mean that they were, for whatever reason, it wasn't compelling because of one of the exceptions I just mentioned. particularly, it wasn't designed to be something to be kept in confidence. It was maybe disseminated throughout the particular corporation. The fact that it's a corporation also makes things a little trickier. The attorney-client privilege applies to the corporation as a client, but we're now dealing with agents of agents mm-hmm. because corporations only can act through people. And we have the people involved, and then they're acting on behalf of the corporation, but what about their own involvement and interest and so forth? So it does get a little tricky. I think it's, frankly, a little premature at this point because there are no specific documents that, at least I've seen, that have been identified and publicly discussed as being a question of whether this should have been even available because of the attorney-client privilege. What is interesting, and there's another attorney-client privilege story in the news that I think is important and very significant, is the appeal that the U.S. Supreme Court has just taken of the request by Ken Starr to get a hold of the notes made by Vincent Foster's lawyer before Vincent Foster committed suicide. The argument is this is important information to try to look into the grand jury investigating Whitewater activities. And Vincent Foster is dead, and there's no other way to get this information. And the attorney-client privilege that otherwise was in existence essentially expired when Vincent Foster did. in fact, I think this is a bad argument. I'm surprised that the lower federal courts bought it, and the case is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think for the policy reasons we discussed earlier, that the attorney-client privilege ought to survive the client who's making mm-hmm. these statements in confidence, just like we would not want our medical records splashed on the third page of the newspaper merely because it's now a week after we died. I think this would have a chilling effect upon people and their willingness to speak to their attorneys or their doctors or others if they thought that somehow the privilege that they thought present would mm-hmm. not last beyond their own death. Having said that, I want to mention quickly that this is the kind of stuff about which reasonable men and women can differ, and I disagree with Ken Starr's approach in this, but because he has been vilified in the press and smeared by the spin doctors from the White House, I want to emphasize that in my judgment, Ken Starr, in fact, is doing an entirely appropriate job in all respects except that one. And the other one where I disagree is a matter of policy in his efforts to call Sidney Blumenthal and one other White House person to before the grand jury. I don't think that was necessary or a good thing to do. But, it's really a shocking and shameless display to see the President of the United States and his denizens attacking a prosecutor's office and the press just going along with it.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Illinois Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. This is our monthly look at the law in you. If you would like to talk with us this afternoon, give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Another Whitewater matter in the news. Susan McDougall was brought into Arkansas once again and has apparently said she will not testify.
It's another privilege sort of issue. Mm-hmm. She is, in effect, claiming a privilege not to testify, and she doesn't have one. Now, what's interesting is, and this is something that, again, I'm astonished that the national media has done such a bad job of portraying what the issues are here. Susan McDougall is a convicted felon. She's also going on trial shortly for defrauding Zubin Mehta in California when she, having nothing to do with Whitewater or Bill Clinton or any of that stuff, but having everything to do with taking advantage of some trust the famed conductor had given to her, and she stole some of his money too, is the argument. Connected with this investigation of Whitewater activities, she has already been convicted. And the independent counsel, Special Prosecutor Ken Starr, has sought her testimony before the grand jury. She has claimed the Fifth Amendment privilege. Now, once you're convicted, generally you don't have one anyway. But without getting to technical legal details, that was an issue that they decided not to fight. So they said, well, we will give you use immunity. that is, immunity from anything you say in the grand jury, so you can't be prosecuted based upon any of that. And they took the matter before a federal judge who agreed with that and ordered Susan McDougal to testify. Going back to what I said earlier, no citizen has a right not to testify before a grand jury or in trial because you don't want to, because you don't like the lawyer asking you questions, because you don't like the case, because you don't like the investigation. Fill in the blank. It doesn't matter. There's no excuse for it. Interestingly, the judge who ordered her to testify and who imposed the prior contempt sentences upon her failure to do so is Judge Susan Weber Wright, the same judge who has been otherwise canonized in the press recently for having dismissed the Paula Jones suit. But somehow her canonization didn't include the part of ordering Susan McDougal to testify. Her claim is that she doesn't want to testify because she thinks Ken Starr is ill-motivated. Assuming for the moment he is, it wouldn't matter. Assuming for the moment that somehow she disapproves of what he had to say, it wouldn't matter. And what also is interesting about this is Susan McDougal, James McDougal, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton were the four major partners behind the Whitewater Enterprise. I mention that because this goes how far back she and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton go. During all this time of the refusal to testify and her sitting in jail, Bill Clinton has never said, the former professor of law at the Arkansas Law School, by the way, taught constitutional law. These concepts I'm discussing here are not unknown to Bill Clinton. Has never said, Susan McDougal, why don't you just obey the federal judge? Testify, let the chips fall where they may. I'm not asking you not to testify. Go ahead and do it. That statement has never come out, and to my knowledge, no one in the national media has ever asked, or if they've asked, has ever gotten a response from the president as to why he isn't saying that. The important point to get across is there is no privilege or justification for Susan McDougal not to testify now. As a matter of fact, when she gets before the grand jury, who is composed of 23 citizens chosen from just off the streets like any other jury, there she is in Arkansas, she can say, I don't know how they could shut her up if she wanted to, she could say anything she wanted about her theories and her animus towards Ken Starr and why she thinks he's a bad guy. The grand jurors are all there to listen to her, but she refuses to say anything at all.
Let's take some calls. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Good afternoon. Your Honor, I had the pleasure of meeting you at the College of Law Centennial a few weeks ago, and wanted to maybe just bring up a couple of topics that have been in the news lately. We didn't get a chance to talk about at all that evening, but the I was wondering maybe you've already commented on this. I tuned in a little bit late about the sexual harassment cases that have been recently argued in front of the Supreme Court, particularly with the vicarious liability of businesses. And maybe comment on that. And then if I know in your capacity as an appellate court judge, maybe you don't hear this case, this issue as often, but the issues of alternative dispute resolution and whether you think those are good things for civil law in America, or if they are as effective as perhaps they've been billed to be, or if there's if you think that litigation is still a better way to resolve a lot of these civil disputes. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks
sure.
for your call.
I'll take the first or the second question first. ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution, the initials are, I think can be effective, but we have to be careful not to force people who want to get their day in court to settle for court-enforced mediation. Often it's the case, and it was my experience as a trial judge, that sometimes people just wanted to be heard by some neutral arbiter and be told a neutral, legitimate sort of assessment of what their complaint is. And based upon that, I think cases can be resolved and settled. I think in large measure that's one of the things ADR does. And it can be effective in moving cases along and reducing a backlog. And if the settlement proposed by a mediator is rejected, the parties still can have their day in court and be heard by the full-blown trial exercise that we understand it to be. So it has the potential, and I think to answer the question directly, it generally works to help the system become more effective and more efficient and get cases resolved more quickly. With regard to the sexual harassment issues argued before the Supreme Court, it's an interesting question, and it might have some impact on Paula Jones's case because essentially the issue was how much direct harm does a woman have to show when she says she has been the victim of sexual harassment to her career or otherwise before she can bring a case. And that was, I think, the reason why the case was dismissed in Paula Jones's situation, because the trial judge there thought that she was unable to show that her career was sufficiently adversely affected, if adversely affected at all, as a result of the actions that Bill Clinton allegedly took. It's, by the way, Celeste, here's another important point. The national media talking heads have the Paula Jones decision all wrong. It was not a discretionary ruling by the trial court, and it will not be given that sort of deference on appeal. It was a motion for summary judgment. And in a motion for summary judgment, the trial court reviewed depositions, interrogatories, documents, and the like, and has the issue before the court of this. Is there a genuine issue of material fact regarding any of the claims that the plaintiff has made so that this case should proceed to trial? The issue is not who's telling the truth. The issue is not will the plaintiff win a trial. The issue is not is this a close case. The issue is there any case at all. And in resolving this, the judge has to decide it on the basis of essentially assuming the things that the plaintiff says and in their affidavit claims to have occurred are true. Is there any case at all? I emphasize this last point because, again, we're talking about a former professor of constitutional law at the University of Arkansas understands these distinctions, how awful and intentionally misrepresenting it was when Mike McCurry, the president's spokesman, termed this dismissal a, quote, vindication, unquote, of the president's position. It was not that at all, and they knew it was not that at all, that the federal judge made no judgment as to who was telling the truth and who wasn't. The federal judge said, assuming Paula Jones is telling the truth, I do not believe, as the trial judge, that there is enough evidence here to permit this case to go forward because there's insufficient evidence to show that Paula Jones was hurt as a result of what happened. Now, the problem with this, I believe it's unduly narrow. And when a case comes up on appeal, it is not deferential. It will be reviewed de novo. That's the legal term that means essentially of anew, all over again, because the appellate court can consider the same documents, the same interrogatories, deposition, whatnot that the trial judge had. The trial judge was involved in no credibility balancing. That's where deference particularly comes in. What's a deferential ruling? Take a divorce case. Who should be custodian? What should visitation be? What should be a child support? How should the property be divided? These are all deferential decisions or discretionary decisions to which the appellate court is very deferential. De novo decisions, the appellate court is not deferential at all. I think this was an unduly narrow ruling in the Paula Jones case. My prediction is it's going to be reversed, and here's why. Let's take two examples. You have woman X and woman Y. They are both employees of Big Bucks Corporation headed by some CEO guy. Assume the CEO, the big boss for Big Bucks Corporation, makes sexual advances to woman X. Let's assume, as the trial judge would have to, advances of the same nature as Bill Clinton is alleged to have with regard to Paula Jones. She turns him down. Nothing happens to her employment or her career. She's not fired. She doesn't advance. She essentially stays where she is. Woman Y, also in the same position, very low level. She is hit on in the same fashion by the employer. Submits and complies with these requests and provides sexual favors for the big boss. And her career skyrockets. She's advanced. She's promoted. She gets all kinds of benefits that no one in her position normally would be entitled to. And, of course, when people say, what's the connection of Monica Lewinsky to the Whitewater investigation, this is exactly, or to Paula Jones, this is exactly the connection because Monica Lewinsky had the lowest of the low positions, an unpaid volunteer, who suddenly, supposedly as a result of providing sexual favors, was given access to the White House that the CIA director didn't have, who was taken around by the leading lawyer mover and shaker in Washington, Vernon Jordan, to job interviews, was provided a job interview with a cabinet-level officer, the U.N. ambassador, Bill Richardson. Things that might be coincidental, but a skeptic could look at this and say, this does look like a quid pro quo of some sort. Under sexual harassment law, going back to the X and Y situation, does woman X have a claim for sexual harassment because she did not get advanced, as woman Y did, for providing sexual favors? I believe the answer is yes. And I think the judge in Little Rock viewed it unduly narrowly, and I think that's one of the issues that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals will be addressing.
Hmm. I'll have to think about that.
And what's interesting is I would think most women, who, if they understood the issue this way, would say, well, the law should provide that this is a bad business, that a woman who turns down sexual advances and her career goes nowhere ought to have a cause of action when her female colleague has a meteoric rise for essentially the casting couch idea.
Let's take another call.
Sure.
Our next caller on line 4 in Eureka. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to go maybe back to the state and a little bit lower level. About, what, three or four years ago, there was a great thrust in the General Assembly to have legislation which would have changed tort law for, I guess, maybe what I would interpret like ordinary slip and fall negligence type lawsuits. I wonder if the judge could comment on whether he's seen that legislation has any effect. Does he see any further remedial legislation coming down?
Well, we had the Tort Reform Act of 1995, as it was called, and the Illinois Supreme Court ruled it all unconstitutional on the grounds that it was excessive, it violated various constitutional provisions. It's hard for me to summarize since it was a 98-page opinion that the Supreme Court rendered, but it essentially threw it all out. This is the one that had caps on non-economic damages. Those are damages for pain and suffering. I think the cap was $500,000, no matter how severe your injury may have been or how long you may have to live and to endure the pain and suffering you received. And the Supreme Court analyzed the Illinois Constitution, various provisions contained therein, and said that this act was in violation of it and threw it all out. So as we now stand, there are proposals to try to reenact some portions of it, which were not actually, the court threw out, specifically addressed about 6 or 7 provisions, and there must have been 20 or 30 of them, and said because these 6 or 7 are unconstitutional, we're going to say the whole act is unconstitutional, leaving open the idea of coming back to try to reenact separately, perhaps, the individual provisions of the bill that were not directly addressed.
Has any of that, none of that has been introduced or passed since then?
Well, it hasn't been passed. Now there's been a change because the House of Representatives in Illinois is now under Democratic control, and the Democrats are not receptive to some of the proposals that the Republicans had put forth in 1995 when the bill was originally passed.
Do you, in your opinion, believe that that reform bill had a lot of merit and things that needed to be changed?
Some things, but, you know, regrettably, the bill had a lot of problems. I don't know why the legislature at the time threw this all together as a one big package, and so that those provisions that were terrific were lumped in with some that were questionable and lumped in with some that were seemingly pretty clearly unconstitutional, and everything went up in smoke. So it's hard to say, and I would hope that the legislature would come back and reconsider these issues. And if your question is, does the civil justice system in the state of Illinois, could it use some tuck-pointing and fine-tuning? You bet. Of course it could. There are always things that we can do to try to make it more efficient, more effective, more cost-effective, to get results more timely, to avoid abuses in the system that might exist. But I think the legislature, as it tries to address these concerns, has to do it in a careful and deliberate fashion. And that was one of the problems I think the Supreme Court of Illinois found with the product that they came up with in 1995.
Thank you very much, sir.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's go back to our employees, X and Y.
Okay.
And I think it was why who we had acquiescing.
Right.
Given that situation, would any employee in the corporation have a complaint?
Well, I don't think so, because you remember X also was
approached.
She was asked for sexual favors as well and turned them down. If your question is, would arguably any female employee similarly situated to X, who was asked for sexual favors and turned them down, have a cause of action against the company or the big boss who received what he was looking for from Y, whose career skyrocketed? I think the answer would be sure. And why not? You know, it's like a USC law professor wrote, and I liked it. I had kept this quote. She wrote, "Does the law say each boss gets to ask each female worker for oral sex once as long as he doesn't force her when she says no?" I don't think that could be right. And that's essentially where we now stand, by the way, with the dismissal on the Paula Jones case. She writes that there would be precious little protection for women if all male bosses were entitled to one free hit.
Well, I think this is a very – and this, these kinds of questions, I think, are before the Supreme Court now in the latest – in the fourth case that has come before them this term on sexual harassment, because there's this issue of, if I'm not harmed economically, does it count as sexual harassment? On the other hand, couldn't we say, isn't this a hostile environment?
Well, I think that may be one other aspect of sexual harassment, the hostile environment, the ongoing hostile environment. But I think is one instance of this kind, a hostile environment where a request was made for sexual favors and turned down. I don't know. I think that might be a tough thing to establish as well. The hostile environment cases are usually ongoing sexual pratter of some sort. Prattling about one's a coworker's sexuality or making dirty jokes or things of this kind, that unwelcome comments to some woman over a period of time. I'm not sure now, which isn't to rule it out. Perhaps one instance might be strong enough.
It's so broad. Hostile environment is large.
It is broad. But one thing, by the way, that's interesting, and I hope you notice this. As we've just been discussing these topics, we've been discussing them in the context of the legal issues involved. We haven't been discussing them in the context of the politics involved. And as a judge, I'm particularly sensitive to the fact that the politics, that is, who Ox is going to be gored and is this going to help the Democrats or Republicans, doesn't matter on these legal issues. They have a life of their own, which is one of the reasons I mention that is to express my strong criticism of the non-action of the National Organization of Women, who have decided that this is an issue, notwithstanding the importance of it, as you've heard me discuss, that somehow this is a woman whose issue, whose case, forget about who she is, her case doesn't deserve support because of whom she's aligned herself with. That's not how the law works. And I think it's unfortunate that we have a group that's supposed to be concerned with women and women's rights abandoning this issue.
Well, law and the politics are...
No, they're not. They are not irrevocably intertwined. The issue I just mentioned here, the one has nothing to do with the other as we are dealing with it as a matter of law. Does X have a cause of action? I didn't ask, and I don't care as a judge, if she's a Republican or a Democrat. I didn't ask, and I don't care as a judge, what the political makeup of the big boss might be or who gets hurt by it. We judges don't care about those kinds of things.
But the National Organization for Women is not a judge.
Well, but they claim to be a legal defense fund. That was the group that's involved in protecting
a political legal defense
protecting
fund.
Women's legal rights. And, let the record be clear that it's now the National Organization of Leftist Women. And if you're not lone foot into that category, I guess you are, even if you have a claim as a woman, it's not going to be supported.
Let's take another call. It'll probably be our last call today.
Okay.
On line one in Champaign. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
My question, Judge, going back to Susan McDougal, is, as I understand it, she has already served 18 months of a sentence for contempt. she will probably be asked to respond to the same charges again. Doesn't this come close to double jeopardy, or can she just be kept in contempt over and over and over again?
That's an interesting question.
No, it's not double jeopardy. There are no charges as such. And this is a case of criminal contempt, or indirect contempt, rather, because she is being asked to testify, and she has the keys to the jailhouse in her own pocket. By that I mean she can get out of jail any time she wishes by complying with the judge's order. And how long has she been kept there? There's really no limit to how long she can be kept. As long as the only outside limit is a technical one where it's now become punitive because it appears she's never going to testify. But that's something where the judges and the courts are very reluctant to reach that conclusion because it tends to reward people who have been put in that position. There was a guy in Illinois who served at least 7 years in jail
for
the same for contempt for failing to answer a question. He had taken his daughter, I think it was, on a weekend visitation, and she never showed up. And, you know, no one ever knew what happened to her, and he wouldn't say. And the judge ordered him to say, and he wouldn't say, and he sat 7 years in jail. And my thinking is, let him sit another seven. Let him sit 20. Let him sit the rest of his life. And as far as Susan McDougal is concerned, you know, as with this guy mentioned, the keys to the jailhouse are in her pocket. She has gotten in the face of the federal judge who said, you have no claim to testify. She said, well, I'm this martyr. And say, well, hey, you want to be a martyr? Sit it out. There is no double jeopardy. This is not a criminal matter. She is not being held for a crime. She's not being prosecuted a second time for a crime. She is being asked to testify before this grand jury. And as long as the grand jury is in existence and she chooses not to testify, she can be held in jail.
That's where we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Gee, a lot of stuff still to talk about.
I know, and there were so many questions that came out of our discussion as we were talking. We'll just have to get together again.
Oh, it sounds good.
Our thanks this afternoon to Illinois Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. He serves on the 4th District Appellate Court.